second case, Juergens v. Marias Medical Center. And Ms. DeLong, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Joanne DeLong, and I represent the plaintiff appellant in this appeal, Jeanette Juergens. I wish to reserve 1 minute of my time for rebuttal. There are five arguments necessitating the reversal of the district court's decision granting summary judgment to defendants' appellees. Those five arguments, first off, are that Juergens can show a interference or denial of the exercise of her FMLA rights. She can show that she was prejudiced by the violation of the employer's duty under the FMLA, under the Code of Federal Regulations. She can show that the activities of one of the defendants, Cindy Lamb, the human resources director, was willful, which raises the 3-year statute of limitations. She can show that the statute of limitations should begin running from February 28, 2017 on this cause of action. And finally, she can show that res judicata is not applicable in this case. The facts that are most applicable.
Can I start with the statute of limitations question? Is your argument that there's a discovery rule that kicks in and she didn't have a basis for knowing when her right started to accrue, and that's why she's entitled to a 2017? Because otherwise it would have, I mean, on the plain language, it would have started to run in 2015, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Yet the issue under the FMLA in this case is that a medical record, a letter from her doctor to the human resources director, was listed in listed as a relevant document in an investigator's report, allegedly showing misconduct at work by.
But that all happened in 2015, correct?
That's correct.
So the only way that you can take, your client could take advantage of that, is if the discovery rule applies, and she, and that claim accrues when she discovered it in 2017.
That's correct.
And where's the basis for that? Is there a case that says that we should apply the discovery rule in to the FMLA in these circumstances?
I have a list of various statutes and cases. For instance, it's stated the best in an old Ninth Circuit case from 1977 called Briley. This had to do with 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, but the quote is that the established rule, which we apply in this case, is that where a plaintiff has been injured by fraud or concealment and remains in ignorance of it without any fault or want of diligence.
So, counsel, let me stop you there, because I don't see the fraud or concealment. I understand that you didn't, that she says that she didn't see the letter that should have been provided in the course of discovery. But the fact that she went to her doctor was not a surprise to her, was it? Didn't she know that she had gone to the doctor?
No.
Didn't know that she had gone to the doctor in 2015?
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So she went to the doctor. Did she know that the doctor was providing a letter to her employer?
No.
She did not know that. Why would the doctor send something to the employer without mentioning this to her?
I don't know that.
Wouldn't that be a violation of HIPAA or some other kind of privacy rules to have a doctor disclose a medical diagnosis to an employer without the knowledge of the patient?
Well, it's a little complicated, Your Honor. The doctor worked for a health clinic called Marias Healthcare, which was affiliated with the defendant Marias Medical Center. In fact, they share the same building.
Okay. But this was her doctor, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and she went to the doctor because she had anxiety and depression.
Correct.
So she knew she was suffering from anxiety and depression. Would that suffering from anxiety and depression qualify her for FMLA leave?
It ultimately did, and that's
does her employer have to advise her of that?
The employer has a duty under the Code of Federal Regulations to inquire of the doctor or the employee to determine if the FMLA applies or not. But how
was she prejudiced by any of this in any event, since she was given leave under a different provision?
She was prejudiced by the inclusion of the doctor's letter, a medical record, in an investigator's report on her alleged misconduct at work. It was listed as a relevant document, among other documents, having to do with disciplinary actions and complaints by coworkers, etc. February 28, 2017 is the first date that the plaintiff was aware that her medical condition may have influenced the decision to terminate her employment. The investigator's report...
She brought a lawsuit for... and she won. She won on the fact that she was wrongfully discharged. There's nothing in the FMLA that says you can't discharge an employee. So she says she was wrongfully discharged. She brought a lawsuit and she won. So what more is there to it?
She won on the claim of wrongful discharge from employment, a Montana statute that limits her recovery to 4 years of lost wages, which was significantly less than her actual damages. She had no way of knowing that her medical condition may have influenced that decision to terminate her employment, which caused her damages of several hundred thousand dollars. So we argue the correct date for the statute of limitations to begin to run would be February 28th, when she discovered this investigator's report. It's an established fact. The human resource director, in writing, in a letter to Jurgens, said that she was basing her allegations of misconduct on the investigation. And Jurgens was later terminated 2 weeks later for those allegations.
The thrust of the letter, if I recall correctly, had nothing to do with firing her or anything like it. It was all about, please give her some leave, and they were already giving her greater leave than she would be entitled to under the FMLA.
In 2015, she was on paid leave. But the issue is, to what extent did that medical record, being listed as a relevant document in the list of documents showing misconduct, to what extent, I believe it's an issue, a genuine issue of material fact for a trier of fact, to determine whether the inclusion of that medical record influenced their decision to terminate her employment. And she would have no way of knowing. She was not privy to that investigator's report, obviously.
That's not an FMLA claim, counsel.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's not an FMLA claim. The FMLA does not prevent her from being terminated.
Although
it's irrelevant.
There is case citations that the FMLA does not prohibit a legitimate reason for discharge. And this is getting a little complicated, but her discharge was determined to be wrongful.
Right, and she's already won that. She's already put that one to rest. She collected a judgment on that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
You're essentially asking for a double recovery.
No, in prior pleadings, the plaintiff has noted that she recovered X amount of dollars, $80,000, under the Wrongful Discharge from Employment Act. And of course, that would have to be accounted for in any recovery under the FMLA.
Okay. Do you want to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Higgins?
Excuse me. Good morning. May it please the court. Mark Higgins for appellees, Marias Medical Center, Toole County Commissioners, and Cindy Lamb. I am very honored to present oral argument today in this magnificent courthouse that happens to be named after a distinguished jurist who grew up 23 miles down the road from where I was born and raised and where I live today. So that's quite a coincidence and an honor.
Talking about guilt by association?
we'll draw our own conclusions, Your Honor. As I know, it's fully apparent to this court, the plaintiff can prevail on this appeal only if she can overcome multiple independent bases for dismissal. She faces a substantive bar to both her FML claim and her 1983 due process claim. She faces a separate independent statute of limitations bar to both claims. She faces a separate independent res judicata claim, bar to both claims. And further, she has a separate independent qualified immunity problem.
Is the prejudice, if we say there's no prejudice, would that would apply equally to both claims?
No, the prejudice requirement is only under the FMLA, Your Honor, but it is it's a deal breaker.
But statute of limitations would be the same for both claims.
Statute of limitations and res judicata are the same for both, Your Honor. Yes. So in order to prevail on this appeal, Ms. Juergens basically has to clear 7 hurdles. And since we're directed on oral argument to clarify issues, I'd like to speak to a couple of issues that I briefed, and so I raised them, and the court didn't reject them. He simply did not address them, probably because there was a wealth of other grounds. Ms. Juergens brought a Monell claim because there's 2 entities, the Board of Commissioners and the medical center, and of course, entity claims under Section 1983 can't depend upon respondeat superior. They have to be based on some sort of policy or custom. And policy or custom is alleged nowhere in the complaint. In fact, Monell's not even mentioned in the complaint. And I might add, Your Honors, and you may find this in several instances, none of this is addressed in appellant's brief. And as we've submitted under the Independent Towers and Acosta Huerta cases, those simply should be considered abandoned on appeal. Another of the bases that was not addressed by the district court, but I think bears mention, is this idea of there's just absolutely no notice of a desire or need for FMLA leave. Your Honor, with all due respect, this letter was very short. It mentioned medication and avoiding stressful situations, but it honestly did not say anything about, so she probably shouldn't work or she needs to be away from work. But again, it's a very short letter. The court, in this court in Batchelder said, as does Title 29, that there has to be some kind of notice. You don't have to use the magic words, employer, I need FMLA leave for the following reason. We don't submit that that's the case, but they have to ask for leave of some kind. They have to say, I've got to be gone from work. And, of course, here that didn't happen because she was already – the doctor's note was a week after she was already on paid administrative leave. So not only did the doctor's note not address it, she never said, I need to be off work. In fact, when I deposed her, she said, I didn't need leave. I could still do my job. I didn't want leave. Those are exact words in her deposition. Now, apart from the flaws that were pointed out, and I don't think I'll spend much time because Your Honors have already raised this, is the absolute need for harm or prejudice. This woman could not possibly have been harmed or prejudiced by not being afforded FMLA leave because she was already on paid administrative leave. Both the statute and our policy and procedure that she was given and our poster that she saw stated that if you're going to take FMLA leave, we can run it concurrently with vacation or personal leave that you have. So if we had put her on FMLA leave, Your Honors, she would have been worse off because she would have been spending vacation and the like. Instead, she's on paid administrative leave. This idea that she was fired being prejudiced, your honors have already seen through that. The firing has to, in order to be improper under the FMLA, the firing has to be related to a request for FMLA leave. And, of course, there was no such request because she didn't need it and she didn't want it. She was already on leave. Now, shifting gears to the 1983 problem, the most fundamental problem that they have in a case that, frankly, is pretty rife with fundamental problems is that she's based her 1983 claim on an alleged federal constitutional right to full and fair discovery in state court. Over the full life of this case, Your Honors, neither the plaintiff nor the defendants nor even the district court and his law clerks couldn't find a single source, a single case that stood for the proposition that a right to full and fair discovery in state court is secured by the Constitution or laws of the United States. And, of course, lacking a constitutional basis for a 1983 claim based on discovery deficiencies dooms both her it dooms it under qualified immunity and due process analysis. And speaking of due process analysis, if you even do cursory due process review, you're going to find that there are a myriad of procedural safeguards under the rules of civil procedure to address asserted discovery abuse. The plaintiff availed herself of none of those. She didn't file a motion to compel. At hearings, complained to the court, hey, they shortchanged me on discovery. I made a mistake on discovery. I said that the investigative report is attached here, too. It's lengthy, and that's where the letter was. I made a mistake. And as the court said at oral argument, well, Mr. Higgins, if you did it willfully, you're not very good at it because you showed up at her deposition and handed it to her. I made a mistake. That mistake was rectified 442 days before that case went to trial. She had plenty of time to recover from that. So, got a couple of minutes. It seems quite telling on the court's res judicata analysis that he began with this observation, that this is the third of three cases filed by Ms. Juergens arising just from her firing. And he said, quote, this case highlights clearly the need for this policy. In other words, the policy of res judicata. Res judicata claim preclusion, of course, bars a party from relitigating claims that they have already made or claims that they could have made in a prior action. Here, not only could the plaintiff have joined the claims that are you're hearing today in either of two prior state court actions, she actually did bring them in the second case and then for some reason withdrew them. As Judge Morris found below, this case is a poster child for res judicata, and I don't say that to be flippant. It simply is. The court went through step by step, piece by piece, res judicata analysis. We would submit that it was very thorough and should be upheld. Finally, Your Honors, the trial court did indeed hold that all claims were barred by the applicable statutes of limitations. Now, here's what we know. Ms. Juergens was fired on August 28th of 2015. Obviously, once she was fired, she had to know she wasn't going to get FMLA leave. She doesn't work there anymore. So she knew that day, way back in 2015, that she wasn't given FMLA leave. The fact that her doctor wrote a letter that said she's stressed out, what does that change? That doesn't change anything. So it shouldn't matter if the 2 or 3 year statute of limitations, she's not even close on either one. Finally, with her 1983 claim, the denial of full discovery, that, my mistake, occurred on November 28th of 2016, and any shortcomings were obvious right there. There's no discovery, pardon the pun, rule with this discovery, because I said the report is attached. I messed up, Your Honors. It wasn't attached. When I saw her again in person, I handed it to her. So the statute of limitations has long gone. Unless Your Honors have any further questions for me, I thank you for this opportunity, and I would ask that the court uphold the lower court determination in all respects.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Time for rebuttal. You're on mute.
Sorry. I'm not technologically astute. I would just like to make 3 points. The first is that the defense attorney stated that the plaintiff appellant could not show harm or prejudice. An inclusion of a medical record from her doctor in a list of relevant documents showing misconduct, well, that seems pretty harmful and prejudicial to me, especially when her termination was based on this investigator's report. I believe that raises a genuine issue of material fact for a trier of fact to determine if that had any impact in her termination. Finally, regarding Lamb's misconduct, and it was willful, as explained in the opening brief, many facts. She chose not to do many things required of her under the Code of Federal Regulations, and it's just would be bad public policy to allow the employer to determine whether the FMLA applies, as opposed to adhering to the Code of Federal Regulations and reaching out to both the doctor and employee. Finally, Lamb's willful violation is tied to the medical record being included in the investigator's report. This isn't a situation where you can pick and choose the different facts. It is all a continuum. And the first time that plaintiff appellant Jeanette Juergens learned that a medical record was included in the investigative report on which her termination was based, the first time she had knowledge was February 28, 2017. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments in this case. The case is now submitted.